Chapter 1. The First Not Alone Nut, John Wilkes Booth. The Incident. The assassination of President Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater in Washington on April 14, 1865. The Official Word. The President was shot in the back of the head at point-blank range by a prominent actor named John Wilkes Booth, who escaped on horseback and was later killed by a soldier while hiding in a barn. 8 co-conspirators were also caught and found guilty by a military court. My take? The plot is likely to have gone well beyond those who were rounded up, but except for Booth, we don't hear much about any others in our history books. Besides leaders of the Confederacy, the conspiracy to kill Lincoln probably included people within his own cabinet. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. Abraham Lincoln's Second Annual Message to Congress, December 1, 1862. I had the occasion very recently to be sitting with my nephews, who are of later junior high or first-year high school age. They're here in Minnesota, part of the same public school system that I was. I wanted to get a sense of whether they're still learning the same things in the history books today. So I asked them what they knew about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. It was funny because one nephew immediately said, "Oh, we just got done with that." So it was fresh in his mind. He basically related the same story I'd studied back in the 1950s. This actor named John Wilkes Booth came up behind President Lincoln in the theater, shot him in the back of the head, yelled something as he leapt down onto the stage, fell and broke his leg. He then snuck away, and they tracked him down later and set the barn on fire where he was hiding, then shot and killed him. That was the extent of it. Well, after doing the research for this book, I knew differently. It's not even a theory. There were 8 people tried and convicted by a jury and punished. 4 of them were hung, and the other 4 sent to prison. All co-conspirators of John Wilkes Booth. Why did my nephews not know a thing about that? Why is that eliminated from what's being taught, along with the fact that the plotters had also targeted the Vice President and Secretary of State on the same night that Lincoln was killed? Here was a classic case of a conspiracy going through the court system, yet my nephews today, just as I was earlier, are led to believe that Booth was a lone assassin who had no cohorts. It was just the action of a lone nut. Our history textbooks in our schools are averse to telling the whole story. In the back of my mind, this raises the issue. Is the Lincoln assassination a setup to where that becomes the norm for our way of thinking? That the only people who ever gunned down our leaders are upset over a particular issue that compels them to kill? In this case, of course, Booth was a Southern sympathizer, angered about losing the Civil War. Later, Lee Harvey Oswald would be a die-hard communist, James Earl Ray, a jailbird racist, and Sirhan Bishara Sirhan, a fanatic Palestinian. This becomes the pattern. I see the simplification as part of the dumbing down of our people. So what follows in this chapter is what my nephews ought to have been informed about. First, how far-reaching the Lincoln conspiracy really was remains unknown to this day. For sure, some of the evidence links the plotters to the Confederate leadership. But it also looks like Booth had advance information about Lincoln's movements from someone inside the president's cabinet. And Dr. Samuel Mudd, at whose house Booth took refuge afterwards, wasn't some kindly country doctor carrying out his Hippocratic oath by setting the broken leg of a stranger. He'd been in the conspiracy up to his neck. Unlike the assassins a century later, Booth was well known around the country. He was an American matinee idol who made the then princely sum of about $20,000 a year at the peak of his theater career. Lincoln even saw him once in a play at Ford's Theater called The Marble Heart, and was so impressed he asked to meet Booth backstage. Booth declined. Maybe he already had something else in mind. As Lincoln once put it, "There are a thousand ways to getting at a man if it is desired that he should be killed." As early as when he took the train to Washington for his inauguration, a paramilitary group was prepared to kill him when his train stopped in Baltimore. The plan was discovered, and Lincoln warned ahead of time, so he was already tucked away in a hotel in Washington. But he still resisted the idea of having bodyguards. The next plot we know about involved biological warfare. That's right, it's not a new idea. A group in Canada, which was a haven for Confederate spies, had the notion to spread clothing infected with yellow fever into certain northern population centers. Lincoln was to receive a poisoned, expensive dress shirt from an anonymous admirer. The whole scheme was pretty harebrained and never got off the ground, but the Confederate leadership apparently knew about it and didn't bat an eye before it fell apart. Things got serious after some papers were found on the body of a Colonel Dahlgren, who was killed on a raid while trying to free some Union prisoners. The papers said that once the Union made it into the Confederate capital, Richmond, "it must be destroyed and Jeff Davis and cabinet killed." Of course, this could have been a made-up excuse, but Jefferson Davis is said to have had his agents prowling around the White House area by September 1864, monitoring Lincoln's movements. They were looking to kidnap the president and hold him hostage. Booth hooked up with the conspirators somewhere around this time, after he joined a rebel spy network called Knights of the Golden Circle. His first scheme was to abduct Lincoln from the presidential box at Ford's Theater, but the president didn't show up that night. Then, when Booth found out about Lincoln planning to visit some convalescing soldiers at a hospital on a sparsely traveled road, they decided to try to nab him from his carriage. Again, Lincoln changed his plans at the last minute. Instead, talk about ironies, he went to give a speech at a ceremony held in the same hotel where Booth was living. As late as the end of March 1865, Booth still had a kidnap operation in mind. In one of the books I read about the assassination, it was speculated that the fall of Richmond and Lee's surrender may well have caused Booth to conclude that capturing Lincoln no longer had a strategic purpose. Then there was another plot that didn't involve Booth, to blow up the White House during a meeting of the cabinet. On the night of April 14th, Booth met with three of his co-conspirators around 8 o'clock. This was the first any of them knew about something other than a kidnapping. George Atzerodt was to kill Vice President Andrew Johnson. Louis Paine, accompanied by David Harold, was to take out Secretary of State William Seward at his home. They were all to make their escape from the Capitol on horseback into Confederate territory. The story goes that before he went into the theater, Booth went to bolster his courage in a nearby bar, where a drunken customer told him, "You'll never be the actor your father was." To which Booth replied, "When I leave the stage, I will be the most famous man in America." Now here's the strange part. For Booth to fulfill his mission, it required information that could only have come from the highest sources in Washington. In the first place, Lincoln's attending a play that night hadn't been publicly announced. Carrying a single-shot Derringer pistol and a knife, Booth had to crawl through a crowded theater and then pass through two doors into the state box. How could Booth have known that Lincoln had a substitute bodyguard that night who wouldn't be at his post at the fateful moment? Booth then stood behind the president without being seen by three other occupants, fired his one bullet, jumped onto the stage, and shouted a message to the audience, "Sic semper tyrannis." as always with tyrants, and escaped through a rear exit onto his waiting horse. More than blind luck had to be involved in these skillfully timed movements and activities. At least, this was the way that historian figured it. But with Lincoln himself being so averse to bodyguards and protecting himself, he certainly wasn't surrounded by the security we have today. He didn't want it, and seemed resigned to the fact that if someone was going to kill him, they could. So, to me, how hard could it have been to pull off if you were a determined group of people? At the same time, on the other side of Washington, Lewis Payne broke into Secretary Seward's house and left him and four others bleeding from their wounds. David Harold took off before the mayhem ended. George Atzerodt got cold feet and never even tried to kill Vice President Johnson. This has led some to believe, without any justification, that Johnson was involved in the conspiracy. Booth and Harold then found refuge at a Maryland tavern run by Mary Surratt, who, as an accomplice, later became the first woman ever executed by the federal government. Her son, John Surratt, had also been part of the kidnapping plot. Which brings us to the story of Dr. Mudd. In recent times, President Carter and President Reagan came under some pressure from Mudd's descendants, and both all but declared Mudd innocent of any complicity. Sorry, gang, but your ancestor got off easy. Remember, Booth had a broken leg from the moment he landed on the stage. He bypassed three other doctors along his escape route to make straight for Mudd's house. Later, the doctor claimed he'd never seen Booth before, and so was innocently providing medical care to an injured stranger who needed help. But I highly doubt Mudd was caught completely unaware when Booth rode up to his house. At least, he certainly had knowledge of what was happening. The truth that came out later was this. Mudd had introduced Booth to John Surratt the previous December of 1864. In fact, Mudd was responsible for two key figures being added to Booth's team of conspirators. Booth had earlier been a guest at the doctor's home. For the kidnap plot, Atzerodt claimed Booth sent provisions and liquor to Dr. Mudd's for the supply of the party on their way to Richmond with the president. Even if Booth hadn't stopped off at Mudd's, there was plenty of evidence to have hauled in the physician as one of his cohorts in the Confederate underground. After hiding Booth out, Mudd then bought him two full days' head start by withholding information from the Union soldiers who were tracking Lincoln's killer. But Mudd and his wife couldn't get their stories straight, and 10 days after the assassination, he was taken into custody. At the conspirators' trial, five witnesses, including the doctor's own wife, testified that Mudd had admitted knowing Booth's identity. Mudd escaped the gallows by a single juror's no vote. After an epidemic of yellow fever struck the Florida Keys prison where he was sent, Mudd jumped in to provide medical service and ended up receiving high praise for his efforts. Andrew Johnson, during his last months as president, then gave Mudd an unconditional pardon in 1869. Mudd went home to his wife and four children, had five more kids, and even tried to get elected to the state legislature before he died from pneumonia just shy of his 50th birthday. 12 days after the assassination, Booth and Harold were finally tracked down to the Virginia farmhouse of Richard Garrett. Harold came out of the burning barn and was tied to a tree. Supposedly, Booth refused to come out and was shot in the neck by Sergeant Boston Corbett with a single bullet from a Colt revolver. Corbett, an eccentric religious fanatic, had violated orders to stay 30 feet away and make sure Booth was captured alive. At the time, Corbett was quoted as explaining, "It was not through fear at all that I shot him, but because it was my impression that it was time the man was shot, for I thought he would do harm to our men in trying to fight his way through if I did not." Some, however, think Booth shot himself, And there was even a story that aired on NBC's Unsolved Mysteries that he'd actually gotten away. Here's how that one got started. Booth had been quietly buried under a dirt floor in an old penitentiary, and the secretive nature of his burial raised questions almost from the get-go. One of the Union soldiers who claimed to have been at the Garrett farm said it was somebody else's body. Then in 1907, a Tennessee lawyer named Finian Bates wrote a book claiming that Booth safely made his way south, changed his name, and ended up in Oklahoma. The book sold an amazing 75,000 copies, and the lawyer had Booth's body mummified and took it on the road to exhibit to thousands. As late as 1994, some historians tried to have the original Booth exhumed for DNA tests, but that got rejected. The fact is, of 19 people who viewed the body afterwards, all but one were in agreement it was Booth. You couldn't fake the letters JWB that had been scrawled in India ink on the back of his hand since he was a boy. Besides that, there was a telltale scar, a plugged tooth, and that broken left leg with the old shoe. Which doesn't solve whether Booth was intentionally silenced before he could stand trial, and possibly implicate some higher-ups beyond the Confederates' fanatics. Back in 1937, an amateur historian named Otto Eisenschimmel published Why Lincoln Was Murdered, maintaining that Secretary of War Edwin Stanton was involved in Lincoln's death. In more recent years, The Lincoln Conspiracy, 1977, put forth a similar scenario. For sure, Stanton hadn't started off as a big fan of Lincoln's. A year after the election, he'd spoken of the painful imbecility of the president. It's contended by a majority of historians that his contempt had eventually given way to respect, and that Stanton became staunchly loyal and was always urging Lincoln to accept bodyguards. So while a lot of the charges against Stanton don't seem to have a legitimate basis, from my reading, it seems that some of them are worth considering. First of all, to me, the planning of an assassination isn't going to be carried out by common everyday citizens who are unhappy with the rule of their country and take it upon themselves to change it. When you look at who killed Caesar, it was Roman senators. If there is a conspiracy involved, it's going to include the highest levels. You always need to ask the question, who profits the most? I wouldn't rule out the Confederates, because you could understand the motive of revenge. Certainly, the list of who they'd most like to see die would be the people who directly led to their losing the war. But I tend to think there would also be some kind of help from the Union side. They can have ulterior motives, because politics is the name of the game. When you look at the two political parties today, they can be very cutthroat within their own ranks. Why would you expect anything different back then? During the Civil War, Stanton was the second most important official in Washington, but somehow he wasn't included on Booth's target list. After the assassination, he not only made himself acting president, but took charge of the investigation right away. While others sat sobbing, he ordered a furious dragnet in which civil liberties were ignored and dozens of people were falsely arrested, none of whom had in any way aided the assassin. In the wake of what had happened, that's not too surprising. What does raise my eyebrows is that only a few hours after the assassination, seven names on Stanton's two capture list were part of the earlier kidnap plots. Which leads you to conclude that the War Department must have had prior knowledge, at least about those, and if they did, how come nobody had been arrested already? Then there's the matter of Booth's diary. Yep, Oswald and Sirhan weren't the first assassins to set down their thoughts ahead of the deed. Booth's little red book was supposedly removed from his body after he was shot. The diary was taken to Washington and ended up in Stanton's custody, at which point it disappeared for a while. When it was located in time for the conspirators' trial that summer, Lafayette Baker, the fellow who gave the diary intact to Stanton, said somebody had removed 18 pages. Others who'd seen the diary testified that the pages had already gone missing when Stanton received it, but those were all underlings of Stanton's at the War Department. With Nixon, we'd have the infamous 18-minute gap in the White House tapes that his secretary Rosemary Woods accidentally erased. In the same vein, who could have erased those 18 diary pages of Booth's? One story that surfaced about this came from a congressman, George W. Julian, who said that when he got summoned to the War Department 10 days after the assassination, he discovered Stanton pacing back and forth and saying, "We have Booth's diary, and he has recorded a lot in it." Julian claimed that Senator John Conness from California showed up, and as he was checking out the diary, started mumbling, "Oh, my God. Oh, my God, I am ruined if this ever gets out." Then, according to the congressman, Stanton issued instructions to put the diary in his safe. What's interesting is Senator Conness was one of the so-called radical Republicans who wanted a much tougher Reconstruction policy toward the South than Lincoln was willing to go for. It was alleged that an envelope linking Conness to George Atzerodt, one of the conspirators, had been found in Atzerodt's room, but Stanton didn't choose to follow that up. When Stanton died on Christmas Eve, 1869, it's pretty likely that a lot of secrets went with him. This much we know for certain. 8 Lincoln conspirators were found guilty before a military court on June 30, 1865, and 4 of them were hanged: Powell, Harold, Atzerodt, and Mary Surratt. She was the least directly involved of any of them, but she owned the boarding house and tavern where the conspirators gathered, and she knew enough to have alerted the authorities about what was up. Her son John Surratt was a different story. He'd been deeply involved with Booth in the kidnapping plot. At first, Stanton offered a $25,000 reward for Surratt's capture, but after his mother's hanging, seems to have lost interest. Surratt got to Europe before the Vatican corralled him, but he escaped. Eventually, he did get caught and came back to be tried in a civil court, but the government didn't have the evidence to convict him on a murder charge. So where did Surratt end up? As a respected tobacco farmer in Maryland, who earned extra money giving lectures, and married the second cousin of Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner. Surratt lived to the merry old age of 74, when he died of pneumonia in 1916. He is said to have burned the manuscript of his autobiography a few days before that. One of the recent books has Booth portrayed as a rebel agent who, after Richmond fell, turned his thoughts from kidnapping to killing. A Confederate plot that went at least as high as their Secretary of State, Judah Benjamin, who burned all his papers before he escaped to England and never returned, is today the most accepted of all the conspiratorial possibilities. The Lost Confession of Atzerodt, talking about Booth's knowledge of a Confederate plan to blow up the White House, was discovered in 1977 and bolsters that theory. Still, I wonder if it's a little too pat, kind of like the idea today that Castro had Kennedy assassinated in retaliation for the plots against him. There are some other out-there theories, like Booth being a hired gun of big international bankers, such as the Rothschilds, who didn't like the president's monetary policies, or that the Vatican did it because the totalitarian popes considered Lincoln their enemy. If that piques your interest, you can try to find Democracy Under Siege, the Jesuits' attempt to destroy the popular government of the United States, the true story of Abraham Lincoln's death. I didn't look into that one. Even if Booth's was the only smoking gun, we can safely say that the first presidential assassination in American history involve much more than first meets the eye. Almost a century and a half later, historians are still uncovering new evidence about the plot. Clearly, with the conviction of 8 other co-conspirators, who knows how far it went? That was just where the buck happened to stop. Just like it did 100 years later with Lee Harvey Oswald. What should we do now? Let's start by getting some honesty into our school textbooks about the conspiracy that resulted in the assassination of our greatest president. Our kids should know that groups can and have engaged in plots to pursue their own nefarious ends and undermine our democracy.